Thanks. I'm excited to be here and participate in this session again. I think the first time I participated was 2 years ago, and it was a really exciting session. So today I'm charged with speaking about genetics and race and place, and you'll see that there are certain themes that are consistent across these talks. But today I'll talk, my component will deal mainly with genetics and the issue of race in the context of biology. So, of course, when we think about race and racism, it's mediated by skin color. And so the cell that we will talk about today in the second part of my talk will be the melanocyte, or the cell that produces melanin. It's very important in the production of melanin. And I guess I have to compete with the next door. But I can do that. So inside every cell of our body, this is very fascinating, inside every cell of our body is DNA, genetic material that we inherit from our parents. Half from our mother, half from our father. This genetic material is what we, thanks a lot, what we term the genome. And as I mentioned, half of our genome comes from our parents. They get half of theirs from our grandparents. And the project called the International Human Genome Project was a major project where scientists all over the world were involved in sequencing what is the genetic material that is in these cells. When we started the Human Genome Project, we found that there was a lot more DNA than we actually thought. There were a lot less genes than we thought. In fact, when I started graduate school, I was told there were 150,000 genes. Now we know that there's upwards about 20, 21,000. That's about it. That's the limit. So we're not that far from the nematode, which is a worm, in terms of the number of genes. And so those genes are situated on chromosomes that you see depicted here. There's 23 pairs. So each one of us has two pairs of each one of those. And the 23rd pair is the sex chromosomes, XY. And the Y is what created all the havoc in the world. The guys have to understand that the Y, which is very small, is a very important chromosome, carrying on it the genes for things like keeping the toilet seat up and stuff like that. But the sequence, the DNA sequence, there's 3.5 billion of these nucleotides. For short, we say A, T, C, and G. And the profile or the sequence of these code for those 20,000 genes. What's fascinating also is that when we compare any two people in this room, there'll be some differences. In fact, there could be millions of differences between any two people. Even within families, there could be hundreds of thousands or millions of these differences. We call those differences polymorphisms. Poly means many, morph means forms, many different forms of the DNA. This is important because these polymorphisms that are found throughout the world in different populations actually impact disease and health and drug outcomes. And so if we look at how genetic variation is structured, we find that it's not random. It's structured based on the population history. And so when we look at older populations like African populations, you see the big Venn diagram, the big circle there representing Africa, and then Europe and Asia representing a smaller portion of that genetic variation. Why is the African circle bigger? Because humanity started in Africa. Modern humans evolved in Africa. And then they went into Europe and Asia. What's fascinating, and the take-home point in this, is that 50% of that genetic variation is in Africa. 50% is exclusive just to Africa. You're not going to find it any other place. And so if you're somebody like me who studies genetics, you want to go where the action is, and that's Africa. Only 10% of the variation in Europe and Asia is exclusive to those continents, while 50% is exclusive to Africa. That says something about how not only human migration occurred, but how genetic variation is structured. There's been larger population size in Africa. They've been around longer. And then there's also selective pressure, mainly infectious disease, what we call high pathogen load. And we'll talk more about that later on. You'll hear that in Dr. Mason's talk. But the infectious agents and pathogens have really helped shape the genome of not just Africans, but all of humanity, even before modern humans left Africa. So that's important to understand, too. So this sequence variation is fascinating because some of these sequences code for genes, and they code for a particular protein. And you can have three different variations in that gene, let's say. And let's say two of them lead to no major impact, but maybe one of them may lead to a non-functioning or a low-functioning protein. For instance, sickle cell. How many people know somebody with sickle cell in the room? Of course, a lot of folk of African ancestry raise their hand because it is very common in West Africa. It is endemic in certain portions of West Africa and the Middle East. And it is one that is correlates with malaria. And so here's a situation where the beta globin gene, the gene that is involved in hemoglobin structure and oxygen transport in the red blood cells, is missing. There's a change, a subtle change, that actually impacts the structure and the function of those red blood cells. And so instead of having a circular, it'd be sickle-shaped. It doesn't circulate well through the vascular system, and you can have crises, and some in some cases ultimately die. So that's just due to one variation, just one of these polymorphisms that's in the gene. We've cataloged thousands of these throughout the genome, actually millions of them, and found that for the most part, many of them have these no effects or subtle effects, but some have major consequences, like the sickle cell variant, cystic fibrosis, BRCA1, 2 variants, and others that have a big impact. So the other thing we also understand is that genes don't operate in our bodies in a vacuum. So there's this interaction with other genes and then the environment, be it the physical or even the social environment. And so look at these environmental inputs, whether various exposures, diet, and lifestyles, it actually impacts and interacts with our body's genetic system and creates a response. And that physiological response can lead sometimes to erratic or dysfunctional pathways, physiological pathways, which may lead to obesity or type 2 diabetes or metabolic disease or inflammatory response in a particular tissue and organs that could lead to cancer. And so there's a lot of research going on now trying to understand the interaction between these environmental inputs and our genetic systems. Because the epigenetic mechanisms that operate in that context are very vulnerable to these environmental factors. So, for instance, whether it's methylation, these methyl groups that are, how does this work? I'm sorry. Just pointed them. No, just press that. Oh, okay. Sorry. So these methyl groups that are on these the DNA, the tightly bound DNA, these methyl groups actually impact the expression of these genes. And so if there's what they call hypermethylation, these genes are then not expressed or they're underexpressed. And look, the methylation status changes based on different environmental exposures. Also, we have these different epigenetic factors that can impact a slew of endpoints, be it cancer, autoimmune disease, mental disorders, and diabetes, all of which have been shown to be impacted by these epigenetic sort of related phenomena. When we talk about gene-gene interactions, I think, and also the environment, Alzheimer's is a classic example where we know that there's a variant there, an APOE gene, the E4 variant, that impacts Alzheimer's disease. And we look at the relative risk across populations. That's not a subtle difference across populations. In fact, that's a major difference across populations, which suggests that there's other genes that are interacting, and then possibly also the environment. So here in the Japanese, 5.6-fold of individuals with this E4 variant compared to 1.1-fold increased risk for African Americans. When we look at the frequency, though, it's much more common in African descent populations, that variant, than in Asian populations. So very interesting, and this is not something that is exclusive to Alzheimer's. In fact, we see this across many different diseases, particularly cardiovascular disease. Many genes are modulated by environmental factors or other genes, which impact risk for either myocardial infarction or type 2 diabetes. And I like to show this because this shows people of African descent in different populations in the African diaspora, West Africa, the Caribbean, and North America. This is work by Richard Cooper and Charles Rotini when they were at Loyola some time ago, where they looked at these African populations, looked at BMI and the prevalence of hypertension in those populations. You'll notice in West Africa, folks are lean, and the prevalence of hypertension is pretty low. But then as you go out into the Caribbean, folks are getting bigger, and we see also this increase in hypertension. And then we go out to Maywood, Illinois, which is the suburb where BMI is often, well, it's getting up there. Getting up there, but then also it's quite common you see hypertension in the population. And so folks are like wondering, well, what's going on? But the genetics are pretty much the same. These are all African descent populations. What's different is the environment. And this is a classic example of gene-environment interactions where when you go outside of diaspora and you change diet and lifestyle, it has major consequences in terms of your health. These individuals here, driving Cadillac Escalades, going to Wendy drive-thrus, taking the elevator up two flights or one flight, the folks in West Africa are riding bikes and walking around a lot more. And so we see sort of the lifestyle differences that impact overall health. This is some work that we've done looking at vitamin D and different polymorphisms in vitamin D pathway genes. And we see that the dietary vitamin D intake and a particular variant in this cytochrome P452R1 gene have a major effect in terms of serum vitamin D levels in the body. If you have two copies of this A allele and you your intake is greater than 400 units a day, you have a major increase compared to individuals who have the AG allele and have less intake. This is what we call a gene-environment interaction. The environment here is the intake of vitamin D. So we see higher mean, as I said, levels in homozygous AA individuals, especially those with high vitamin D intake. So let's go to skin color, because this is where the rubber meets the road. So just so you guys know who's black, I'm just showing, these are all black folks. Just so we all know. You look at the spread of skin color. I love studying African Americans because there's so much variation there. We go from Wesley Snipes to Vanessa Williams, or let's say Halle Berry to, yeah, Wesley Snipes. So a wide range of biological variation there that's determined strongly by genetics. So skin color being a genetic trait, also having enormous psychosocial impact, especially in the United States. Race in the United States mainly based on skin color. And I say that because anybody, most people will say, I know who's black and who's white or whatever. But then there's these issues with, for instance, like Vijay Singh. He's not African American. But some people may say he was black if you see him, you know, on the other side of the street or something. But his problem is that he just gets darker after every tournament. He's not African American. He's of Indian or Asian. He's got Asian ancestry, and so he may have trouble, you know, getting a cab with darker skin. But he's definitely not African American. Some of you may have thought that was Denzel. I'm sure. So what is it that sort of that is? Provided this genetic makeup that consistent with this darker skin of African Americans. Well, we look at the genetic features of African Americans, as I mentioned earlier, high genetic diversity. You look across the United States, and I'll show you a map, it varies geographically, the level of biological variation. But the bulk of the gene pool coming from Western Central Africa, Northern Senegal, Southern Angola, 95% of the African American gene pool, or individuals in the African diaspora, because of the transatlantic slave trade, came from this area, about 5% from East Africa. What's fascinating is that only about 500,000 went to North America, enslaved Africans. There were millions that were taken to the Caribbean, and in particular Brazil and Colombia. You guys think the south side of Chicago or one of these wards here in New Orleans is black. You go to Brazil, they have the highest proportion, 80 million black folk, 80 million people of African descent. So it's very, very consistent with the history of the transatlantic slave trade. Those individuals that were brought here, this is what also, another take-home point I want you guys to realize is that local history plays an enormous role in terms of not only genetic variation, but also overall variation in health, the impact of disease or disease profiles. Different communities have different institutions, different histories. And so when the enslaved Africans were brought to North America, there was the British, there was the Spanish, and the French. So we're now in this so-called French territory. Remember, we purchased Louisiana from the French. They behaved differently with enslaved Africans than the British did. In fact, a lot of the anti-miscegenation and the one-drop rule, all of that emerged out of the British, South Carolina, North Carolina region. The Spanish in France also behaved differently with enslaved Africans. In fact, the Spanish were like absentee landlords. They just weren't around. They just said, send the sugar and the cash. It's a Spain, you know, whatever's going on, you guys handle it. And so that's why there's a lot of chaos in Florida, all that fighting and the Seminoles and all that. But the French, you know, this is why I took French in high school, because it was the language of love. Right? The French actually engaged blacks and created a caste, a class structure. We call it a caste system, right? The what is that system here? The Creole system here. The brown bag, right. That was encouraged. In fact, lighter-skinned African-Americans were seen as light-skinned. I'm trying to come up with the word called privilege. That's the word. They were more privileged than those who were of darker ancestry. And so, also, a good thing to bring up is that children born of mixed ancestry in Louisiana, were treated differently than children born of mixed ancestry in the British colonies, like South Carolina. In fact, they were sold as slaves. Even if your father owned you, he would sell you as a slave, right? But in France, in some cases, they actually were sent to, in Louisiana, they were sent to France to be educated. And they would come back with skills. And so then that helped maintain and create that Creole class, caste system. So, but this is where black folk are. This is just the 2000 census. This is two censuses ago, and it's still the same, except for the New Orleans now is more so here. It's darker, it's lighter here, and it's darker here in Houston, you know, with Katrina. You know, there was this movement out. A lot of folk went to Houston. But anyway, the Mississippi River, densely black, this is where you find people of African descent in the United States. You don't see them in Nebraska. Unless they're playing football or basketball. So this is interesting, because we think about segregation. This is Hispanics, southwestern, and African Americans are southeastern United States. These are the percentage across counties in the United States, the proportion of people who self-identified as black or Hispanic. Now, what's the cutoff line? It's Texas, and you have southwest and southeastern Texas. Is that cutoff line? I think it's very fascinating. We think of segregation at a micro level within cities or states, but even at a macro level in the United States, we see consistent segregation. But that's mainly because of the movement of Mexican Americans up into North America, and then of course because of Tiger Woods, we could say that we're mixed. And guess who said they were mixed? Not the African Americans who we know are mixed. Most of them were Native Americans in Oklahoma, and then Hispanics and blacks in the West. And I hope I don't get in trouble with this, but I call this the new blacks. The new blacks. These are folks who sort of embrace all of their ancestry, be it African or white or Asian, and they say they're of mixed ancestry. But you see also mixed ancestry here, but it's that that structure of the strict dichotomy of black versus white. So because of these sort of the mixture, and there's the enormous amount of mixture in the United States, we use these markers called ancestry informative markers to estimate ancestry. And so for the average African American, we use a distribution. Some of us have higher West African ancestry, some of us have lower West African ancestry, depending on our family history. And so we type these markers, we estimate ancestry, and it's a really nice way to show this distribution on these plots. This would be Native American, European, Spanish European, and then African. And the black dots are African Americans, the white dots are European Americans. For instance, Halle Berry, my girlfriend Halle Berry would be in here. She has one white parent, one black parent, and her black parent might not be 100% Mandingo, so she's in this box somewhere, okay? But she's black because of the one-drop rule. And we adhere still today to the one-drop rule. We do not say that Halle Berry's not black. And so we need to understand that, especially when we do these studies looking at the genetics, our drug response studies, because the variation in the African-American population grew enormously. I mean, just enormously once the one-drop rule really came into effect. Because then it was more than just being having all your ancestors coming from Africa. all you needed was one ancestor was black. And that created so much diversity in the African-American population. We look at Hispanics, it's a different distribution. Less West African, more Native American, and this is Spanish-European. The distribution for Mexican-Americans in Colorado, this is St. Louis Valley. Another group of Hispanics, Puerto Rican women. But the distribution is different. Less Native and a lot more West African. And so I tell my students, this is why J-Lo has what she has, because of that. it's not just Puerto Ricans, it's Cubans too, because of that shared experience of slavery. And so that history created the genetic signature that we see today. So I've done a lot of work across the country looking at different African-American communities and looking at genetic ancestry. And so I'm going to talk later today about these four cities that are circled. We call it the Four City Study, where we've published on skin color, genetic ancestry, and SES across those four cities. And you'll see, and also some health indicators, you'll see that still today, there is a lot where race and racism plays a significant role. When we think about genetic ancestry and skin color, we know that in the United States, skin color historically has been employed to characterize populations and classify what they call racially classified social groups, and to stratify opportunity structures and life chances via racism and systematic discrimination. So I don't know if folks believe me or not, but racism is real, and discrimination, whether it's perceived or not, is real and has a physiological response. We know that a lot of that is mediated through skin color, and skin color is also correlated with genetic ancestry. And so we need to really study ancestry and health outcomes because it can entail both biological and sociological factors. It's not just here in the United States. There's a movement in Latin America called pigmentocracy. Where they're studying how education attainment and SES is related to skin color. And it's fascinating because you look at countries like Bolivia and Guatemala where individuals with darker skin attain less educationally than those with lighter skin. We see this across Latin America. So it's not just here in the United States. We see it across different populations of African descent. And what is the main biological sort of predictor or contributor to skin color? It's the melanocyte. It's the cell that everybody has, but some of us have a more active melanocyte than others. And so some will say, well, Rick's 100% Mandingo because his melanocytes are very, very active. Not everybody, but yeah. Well, I thought so. But anyway, the melanocyte is a dendritic cell, and it's situated under the skin, at the bottom of the dermis, epidermis, where they meet. And it actually is very interesting because it's very active from birth, where it produces these molecules called melanosomes, which contain melanin. This is just a picture of melanocytes grown in the laboratory in a tissue culture room, and you'll see the melanin molecules that are being pushed out by these finger-like projections of the melanocytes. Now, as I said, everybody has melanocytes. Some of us are more active than others, and some make more what we call eumelanin, which is brown-black. There's pheomelanin, which is the yellow. And so we've done a lot of work looking at the mechanism, the biochemical and the genetic component of melanin, eumelanin, the brown-black, and also pheomelanin. And it's actually what's different across different populations is that some of us have more of these ion channels that are active. And these ion channels are important because it just manages the pH within those cells. The pH. You could even measure sometimes the pH within a cell or within an organelle within a cell. But the pH is sensitive. I mean, these molecules are very sensitive. These enzymes are sensitive to pH differences. And so that's how one would go from lighter skin to a darker skin just by changing the pH in those organelles. We know that upon UV exposure, there's a stimulation of this hormone, the melanocyte stimulating hormone, which then goes to the melanocortin 1 receptor, and the Golgi signaling protein actually is the antagonist, so it tells that signal to stop. Sometimes this is more active, and so it stops. In other cases, it's not, and it then goes and tyrosine, which is an amino acid, and converts it to DOPA with an enzyme called tyrosinase. I say all of this because we've uncovered a lot of this pathway, some of the genetics, and what we find is that African populations have a more active machinery for this melanogenesis to occur. And we measure skin color with an instrument called a dermispec. Real neat. One of the things we found is that the more African you are, the darker you are. Didn't know that. But it's not 100%. So let's look at it like this. So these people here, this is admixture. So these are all African Americans. As you go to 100, this would be more European. So more European ancestry. So these individuals that are 0% are 100% African. Okay. Look at the distribution of skin color on this axis. This is what we call the M index using the dermispec. You'll notice that there are some people who are 100% African who have very light skin. Okay, so it's not a one-to-one sort of correlation. I think we need to understand. There are many genes involved, and there's light skin even in Africa, in West Africa, in Central Africa. We find, though, African Americans, there's this correlation with higher African ancestry, darker skin. We see it also in Caribbeans, black Brits, Afro-Caribbeans, Puerto Ricans, and Mexicans also. A similar trend with higher African ancestry, darker skin color. We've published on dozens of genes in this pathway. But this is also important to understand. As a model of understanding gene phenotype correlations, I think skin color is a good model because we actually can account for a large portion of the variation just by the genes. But then there's the portion that's impacted by the environment, and that's sort of how we can use that as a model when we study disparities. Because we look at disease or whatever phenotype it is, there's this social component, the genetic component, this interaction that contributes to the disease. Now, disparities real quick. We have this gene-gene-gene-environment interactions. As I mentioned, discrimination, perceived racism, accumulated stress, that allostatic load that just accumulates. Life course selection, cultural factors, behavioral differences, and SES and institutional arrangement. I love this model that Dr. Kamara Jones created where she talked about these health outcomes that are influenced by this racial climate on health, the institutionalized, personally mediated, the internalized. She her part was this up here. So I added another component to this, the ecogenetic, the ancestry, and the gene behavior and the gene environment component on health outcomes. Because, and all of this is sort of encapsulated based on skin color. Because obviously racism, as I said, mediated through skin color, and ancestry also impacted skin color also impacted by African ancestry. This is just a schematic showing the correlation of perceived discrimination and health. And if you want to look more into this, there's the reference. But there have been many articles written on a patient's perceived feeling discriminated against, the perception of being discriminated, and health outcomes. And we see here in this figure that if an individual perceives discrimination by a healthcare provider, it's negatively correlated in terms of health. Health is negatively correlated. Whatever indicator of health you want to use, they're all negatively correlated. The only thing that's positively correlated is the number of chronic diseases. Everything else is negatively correlated. Okay, so it does play a role. I mean, whether it has to do with believing that you and your physician are working as a team to compliance, really. I mean, there could be so many factors how this perceived discrimination plays a role. So the bottom line is, if you're not a white male, you know, that's the issue, right? So we go to the four-city study. We went into Oklahoma City, Cincinnati, Ohio, Washington, D.C., and Harlem, New York. And we went into these cities. We asked some questions about ancestry and attitudes about disease. And we typed some ancestry-informed markers to estimate ancestry. And also skin color measurements. And you'll notice that the higher European ancestry was in Cincinnati, it was about 20%. Oklahoma City was about 18%. New York was about 19%, and D.C. was about 16% European ancestry. And some wonder, why did we go into Oklahoma? Well, there is these black folk in Oklahoma, part of the Trail of Tears. They were part of those five civilized tribes that were moved from Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and Mississippi into these reservations in Oklahoma. So anyway, real quick, what we did was for each, this is just a pooled analysis, this is for everybody. What we did was we asked them to self-report if they were African American or if they were mixed. Because remember, I told you, folks are now saying they're mixed more. So we wanted to see if they self-reported as mixed or African American. But one of the things we saw, though, when we put all the data together was that percentage Native American ancestry, because we looked at West African ancestry, European and Native American, and then also skin color. Native American ancestry was correlated with skilled versus unskilled and professional occupation. And so that was interesting how Native American ancestry, and that was because, in particular in New York, and I'll show you the data when we stratify, that was driven by the New York group coming out of Harlem. It was Spanish Harlem component to that sample set. And the other thing was the self-reported. Everybody pretty much said that they were African American. Not everybody, but there were about 40. How do we do this? Okay, so this is skin color among those that self-reported as African American. As you see, they were darker than those who said that they were mixed. There was higher African ancestry among those who said they were African American than those who said they were mixed, and so on. So it did sort of correlate with what they self-reported at some level. This is for Cincinnati, Ohio, and this is probably one of the reasons why I left Ohio, is because you notice here that the darker skinned individuals, this is the M index for skin color, were more than likely unskilled. I mean, it was a very strong correlation. Professional African Americans in Cincinnati were much lighter than those who were unskilled and or skilled. It's quite surprising when I saw that data. Harlem, New York, as I told you earlier, the Native American component contributing to that correlation with occupation there. Higher Native American ancestry correlating with unskilled occupation. When we look at income in Oklahoma City, we didn't do skin color, we just looked at ancestry. There was a correlation with percentage African ancestry and income. For Washington, D.C., to quite everybody's surprise, we didn't see any correlations. So it's one of those cosmopolitan sort of modern cities for people of color. But we didn't see this stratification based on skin color or ancestry with SES. So I found that to be quite interesting. That's probably why I like D.C. Anyway, I'm going to end with this and we can go on to the next. But remember, when we talk about disease, there's not only this biological genetic component, but the social component too. And I separate race and ancestry. So when we talk about ancestry, that's the genetic component. Race is more of the social component. You know, I don't want to throw race out in terms of usage in biomedical research because it's important. You don't want to throw that out because in some cases it could be a proxy for some shared environment. Think of chicken and watermelon.